Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Ray Suarez, and this is On Point. Lawyers, doctors, scientists, you name it, a lot of our best and brightest in the country are women. Makes sense. But start counting the men and women experts quoted in news stories or invited onto TV and radio talk shows, and you'll see a lot more suits and a lot fewer dresses. Why is that? Well, the reasons are complicated, and so is changing it. This hour on Point, how the news chooses its experts. You can join us on air or online. We've come a long way, right? But have we come far enough? Do you see as many women experts in your news as you do in your workplace? Are you getting the full picture of our society's knowledge base? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington is Adrienne LaFrance, editor of theatlantic.com. In 2013 and 2016, when she was a staff writer at The Atlantic, she started toting up the experts she quoted in her own stories, and she's here to tell us what she found. Adrienne, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining us from Washington is David Leonhardt, Pulitzer Prize-winning op-ed columnist at The New York Times, former Washington bureau chief, and founding editor of the Upshot section for the newspaper. He started checking his own homework. And the result is his recent column headlined, "I'm Not Quoting Enough Women." David, great to have you here as well.
Thank you, Ray.
Adrienne LaFrance, what made you first think that there might be a problem?
I think just being a woman in the world, you notice how women and men are treated differently even when they have the same qualifications and expertise. And as a journalist, I think we have an obligation to think carefully about how we're representing people. So I was really just curious how I was doing.
But you live and work inside the belly of the beast. You know how booking goes down, the reasons why we end up quoting and listening to the people we do. Was there shaving off some of the hard edges of this because you know how this works?
Right. I mean, I do know how it works, but I also – and I assume when you say how it works, you mean that there's enormous time pressure and we live in a society where men outnumber women in many positions of leadership and reporters are often covering people in positions of power. So there are many sort of systematic things that would sort of push reporters toward male sources. So, of course, I do understand that. At the same time, I knew that I believe it's important for women to be, acknowledged and for their expertise to be out there. And I sort of assumed, or hoped at least, that my work might reflect that value. And it didn't.
And when you went back and looked a couple of years later, it must have been a little deflating to see that even with you taking a more mindful approach toward this, the numbers hadn't changed all that much.
Right. So when I first did an analysis, I found that I quoted women about 24% of the time. And I should say that this was total mentions of women throughout about 175 articles over a period of a year or so. And so that was not great. And then I repeated the analysis a couple years later and actually did worse. I was down to 22%.
So David Leonhardt, when did you have your road to Damascus moment where you're struck by the light and you think, I'm not quoting enough women?
For me, there were two things that happened. First of all, in the fall of 2016, with about 6 weeks left in the presidential campaign, I began writing a daily newsletter for the New York Times that I still write. And it's a newsletter where I offer a couple thoughts about what happened in the news the day before, and then refer people to articles that have been written elsewhere that I like, columns and sometimes pieces I disagree with that made me think. And as I was putting it together, I realized, boy, if I'm going to cite three or four pieces a day from elsewhere, from outside the Times, it would really feel wrong to have them all be one gender. And let's be honest about this, that would mean they were all male, because most op-eds and columns and opinion pieces around the web are still written by men. It would be that feeling of being in a meeting and looking around and realizing, oh my goodness, this is an all-male meeting. And so I made a little rule. I didn't announce it, but my rule was that every single newsletter had to be co-ed. I was never willing to have a newsletter that quoted pieces from only one gender. And then a couple weeks ago, people at the Brookings Institution, a think tank here in Washington, reached out to me and told me that Susan Hennessy, who is an expert there, she's one of the smartest people on all of the Trump-Russia stuff, was going to be putting together an online list of female technology policy experts. And that led me to start looking around, and I read Adrian's great piece from 2013 that I really, if people are interested in this and come out of this and want to read more, start by reading Adrian's piece, which is on Medium from 2013. And that led me to do a version of the exercise myself and analyze my own work.
Now, I should be clear that explaining it is not excusing it. So when I read both your pieces involving this, I understood how this happens. I've spent most of my adult life in newsrooms. Crash booking, there's reliable go-tos. Sourcing is derivative, so if you're doing a story, you read up on it, and most of the people quoted in the stories are male. And when you go to them for recommendations on who they think you should talk to, most of the people they recommend are male. So there's a sort of circular nature to all of this. When you have to do something quickly, you go to the last best reliable person you used on that topic. And so you end up using a lot of the same people. And yes, a lot of the same people happen to be male. This is hard to fix, Adrian.
It is hard to fix. And I think an additional recommended read for people is my colleague Ed Yong actually went a step further than I did this year and wrote a piece about his own sort of quest to find women experts and better represent the expertise of women across the science journalism that he does. And he actually built sort of a tracking system for himself where he holds himself accountable more than just every few years, as I was attempting to do.
What's the harm? We understand it. We've named it. We've identified it. You've tabulated it. What's the harm in the way we're doing this?
In the way that
the way we end up quoting mostly men.
Well, I mean, 50% of the population is women, and they're largely invisible and not acknowledged for their expertise, not acknowledged for their life experiences that could help us understand the complexities of the world. If our job as journalists is to help people understand, the forces around us, it, largely ignoring women leaves out a gigantic part of the story.
Does the public come to a different understanding because of different sourcing, David Leonhardt?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, look, as I mentioned Susan Hennessy of Brookings before, she has this nice quote in my column. She said, it's not as if the cream's rising to the top and the cream is 100% or 80% male. And so there's a way in which this is just unfair, right? If we're quoting 80% men, it's not fair because we're not giving people a full view of the expertise and the perspective out there. And it's damaging to people's careers because if you get quoted in The Atlantic or in The Washington Post or in The New York Times or you name it, you then get some other opportunities. You get invited to go on a panel, and maybe someone sees you on that panel and then asks you to join an advisory board for a gubernatorial campaign, and one thing leads to another. I don't, and neither of you have suggested this, I don't think this is a problem that starts with the journalists. I think, look, in many realms of society, for a mix of reasons that obviously include sexism, you have more men than women. You have more men than women in the Senate. You have more men than women on many faculties. degrees, you have them more men than women in all kinds of jobs. And so I don't think this is an issue of it starts naturally 50-50 in these realms and then journalists mess it up. I think what happens is we make excuses to ourselves. We say, well, wait a second, it's not really my fault that I'm quoting so many men and so few women. It's because there are more men in this realm. But that's a cop-out. We can do better, and we can avoid making this problem worse, and we can give a fair representation of what's going on out there and do a better journalistic job without necessarily getting to 50-50 in names in our stories, given the reality that when you mention a president, it's going to be a man. When you mention a senator, it's more likely to be a man than a woman.
Today, the news broke that the summit meeting in Singapore between the United States and North Korea over North Korea's nuclear arsenal has been canceled. And right at this minute, producers and reporters are spinning their Rolodexes, looking for sources on North Korea, looking for sources on nuclear nonproliferation. The news also came to light that the North Korean government brought witnesses to the test site and watched them dismantle and destroy some of the nuclear test equipment. Most of the people, Adrian LaFrance, unless I miss my guess, who are going to be dialed right now while we're talking about this topic are going to be guys.
I think that's probably a good guess. And I can say, too, that our reporter who's writing right now and will soon have, I'm sure, a very smart story on theatlantic.com about this development is Uri Friedman, who's a man and who is the best in our newsroom to cover this. So, you know, the journalism comes first. You go with the best person, the best source, and sometimes that's a man and that's fine.
Right. And I guess we have to separate that out, that idea that, you want the best sources, you want to hear from the best people, but you should be on to yourself, I guess is what you're saying, if it all ends up being men that get quoted.
Absolutely. And I think one way of thinking about this is that in a breaking news situation is not necessarily the best time to seek out a new voice or a source you've never turned to previously, because the time pressure in that situation is even larger than some other stories. I think for reporters who are thinking about how to do better, it starts with the beat and the day-to-day reporting.
We're talking about the experts we in the news business turn to tell you about our world, constitutional lawyers, rocket scientists, and more. And we're asking if, when we think expert, we think man. Later, we'll talk to a former top exec at CNN who back in the early 90s tried to change that. I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
On Bullseye, I talk with people who make amazing work. Greta Gerwig, Errol Morris, A$AP Ferg. The conversations are real and funny, and they take you somewhere unexpected. Find Bullseye with Jesse Thorne on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. We're looking at the experts journalists turn to when we need someone to explain, analyze, predict. Do we still favor the dude in the bow tie over the scientist or government official, well, dressed as a woman? Do you assume the man must know what he's talking about? Follow us on Twitter and find us at Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests are David Leonard of the New York Times and Adrian LaFrance, editor at TheAtlantic.com. In January 2017, women's marches took place around the world. The marches here in the U.S. were the largest single-day protest in U.S. history, and CNN's Don Lemon had a panel of 8 guests on his show to talk about it. Listen to him introduce the panel.
protesters all across America and around the world marching today for women's rights and other civil rights they fear could be under threat from President Trump's administration. A lot to discuss. I'm going to bring in now David Swerdlich, Douglas Brinkley, Jeffrey Lord, Kirsten Powers, Mark Preston, J.D. Vance, Brian Stelter, and Jim Sciutto.
Thank God Kirsten Powers made the table.
A near mantle.
Eight panelists, right, a near mantle. They almost ran the table. They got one woman in there to discuss the largest single-day protests in American history. And, you know, I'm not picking on CNN specifically. This happens in a lot of places, in a lot of contexts, international conferences, meetings in think tanks. It happens in a lot of different venues. But it also, and I'm glad you brought this up, David Leonhardt, it has real career implications. To become a recognized expert on something, you just have to be recognized, and it has an impact on your career.
That's right. And I think that's why you're starting to see some efforts out there. I mentioned earlier this list called Source List that is a list of all female technology policy experts. There's a website called Foreign Policy Interrupted that highlights female voices in foreign policy. There are versions for political science and neuroscience. I think these are all really good efforts because it is important to make sure that journalists and panel organizers and others have places to go. I'll add one thing, which is I'll tell you what I think is missing right now. A lot of these efforts are basically open to all comers, and that's actually problematic for journalists like us. If you come across a list that has 500 female experts in a certain realm, it's actually not that useful. It would be much more useful to have a list of 40 female experts in a certain realm. And I think what's happened is that some of these groups, understandably, they're about inclusion, and so they don't want to be exclusive. But I think it'd be great if someone tried to put together some smaller lists and were willing to be comfortable with the idea of, yes, we're putting together a smaller list. It's going to be all female. And we're going to highlight some of the great voices in this realm. Because one of the things when I've asked journalists about these lists, which again are really important things, I've used them to create Twitter lists, journalists have said to me, some of them are tricky because a list of 500 people just isn't that useful to me, particularly, as Adrian pointed out, on deadline.
Let's stop in Lexington, Massachusetts. Bobby, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Ray. So I actually run one of those databases where I have hundreds of women ready to speak, and we actually are a little bit exclusive. It's called Innovation Women, and it's focused on entrepreneurial, technical, and innovative women, but it's not being run as a public service. It's being run as a business, so we do get a little bit exclusive. And quite frankly, we understand that speaking opportunities and media source opportunities, kind of the same thing. It's all visibility, which drives opportunity. And we are working with event managers, conference organizers, and journalists to provide them with the best voices that they can get out there.
Are you hearing from the women on the list that they're already seeing some changes in who they're contacted by?
Unfortunately, not as many as I'd like to hear. So we are definitely still getting the word out that these resources exist, but having to work with the conference organizers and such who are using the same voices, we call it the all-male, all-pale, all-stale panels, and we get them, we try to get our speakers on these panels so that there can be new voices heard, but we understand it's a catch-22. You know, if you don't see someone on stage, they don't have that credibility. If you don't see and read about them in the New York Times, they're not considered an expert. So they're not reaping the benefits of business. They're not getting the funding. They're not being invited to be a senior person, a board member. And so they don't have the credibility. It just keeps going around and round until someone breaks through. And I'm afraid the responsibility is on the side of the journalists and on the side of the event managers and conference organizers.
Just for the record, I mean, David Leonhardt is pale and male, but not stale.
Thank you.
And that's why he's on this program. Adrian LaFrance, these efforts bubbling up from under sound like they're at least part of the answer. Are they practical to use, these databases like the one Bobby is assembling?
I think it's great that people are doing this. I also think that reporters need to do their own legwork. We're getting suggestions from people all the time about who we should talk to as journalists. And I think that it's really important to be seeking out your own sources and certainly putting calls out in terms of, you know, you could tweet or email people that you trust and ask them, sort of say, I'm looking for more women experts who can inform my reporting on machine learning or whatever it may be. But I wouldn't rely just on lists. I think that it's really important to sort of find your own path as well.
Columbus, Ohio is next. John, welcome to the program.
Hello. I think there's something of a red herring and a diversion. If we're only going to be considering the gender or the race, I think the most important thing is what vested interests are hidden behind whether a person is white, black, Democrat, Republican. This idea that you've come a long way, baby, Gina Haspel, because an advocate of torture has now become the head of the Central Intelligence Agency. And I think if you look at actual proven Senate and congressional committees previously, when we had some honest politicians, the Church and the Pike Committee documented that the CIA is dominating our media, has many hundreds of people actually working as disguised agents for the Central Intelligence Agency. I would also mention that if you use two Ks in a search, Kevin Close, director of NPR, was also longtime director of CIA propaganda broadcast. This is what we have to be concerned about, because we're being led into war by powerful, sinister agencies of the CIA that are the mouthpiece for what we're learning about the world.
John, you're leading us a little bit further afield. But if you're doing a story on advances in, let's say, consumer computing technology or something on astrophysics, you're not using a political filter, are you? I mean, part of this, I understand the point you're trying to make, that we have to think about more than just gender or racial identity or ethnic identity or anything like that. But just plainly put, a world where all the authority gets to be exerted in explaining the world by men, is that a world you want?
No, I'm talking about foreign policy, the demonizations of all the countries that are on the hit list of the CIA and the Pentagon, and all of these Pentagon types of so-called experts that are brought on, everything from CNN, Fox to MSNBC and NPR, and just hearing hearing this latest news broadcast saying that Gaddafi, horribly tortured by a terrorist funded by the CIA, was killed by his own people. I think that is a gross example of the kinds of lies we're being told that are leading us into wars against Korea, Libya, North Korea, Russia, and China. That we're hearing only from people like, as you mentioned, the Brookings Institute, which is highly funded by the CIA and the Pentagon and Fortune 100 companies military industrial companies that have a vested interest in skewing the propaganda, the news we receive to demonize countries to set them up for war.
John, thanks a lot for your call from Columbus, Ohio.
Ray, can I make one
point, please,
about that? So I disagree with the caller's description of the CIA's role in our society, but I do think he makes a broader point that is worth emphasizing. We're focusing on gender in this conversation. I think it's right to focus a conversation. You can't talk about everything in every conversation. But it is true that this is not the only issue for diversity in the media. The media doesn't have enough African-American and Latino and Asian-American voices. It doesn't have enough voices from people who didn't come from privileged backgrounds. It doesn't have enough voices who are hunters, who are deeply religious. There are obviously parts of American society where the reverse is true, and we don't have enough voices that are secular. But I do think the caller is making an important point that as we think about this, there are other good conversations to have about ways in which the national media should have a more diverse set of voices, even if I think it's appropriate to focus on gender in this conversation.
David and Adrienne, let's bring Gail Evans into the conversation. She was an executive vice president at CNN. In 1991, she created a talk show with a female host and a mandate to book only women experts for their panels. The show was called Cryer and Company, later known as CNN and Company. Today, she's a professor at Georgia Tech's College of Business and joins us from Atlanta. Gail Evans, great to have you.
Hi, great to be here.
Why was this necessary in 1991? Is it surprisingly still necessary in 2018?
Regrettably, all these things are still necessary because unless you're intentional, it's difficult to stand up to the culture. And the messages in our culture and in many cultures around the world are that leadership, authority, power is male. And what we kept discovering at CNN was that behind 90% of these important men who were on the air, there was some woman who was the researcher or the woman who was doing the briefing paper for them or even answering the questions when the researcher called. But they were never in front of the camera. And I do believe that diversity matters, that if we don't hear from all different voices, and I would add, you know, disabilities. I mean, there are a million different categories we can put in diversity. But more than half of our population is female. And if the way we learn about the world is all male, we're losing a perspective.
Gail Evans, society has changed a lot since 1991. Opportunity ladders and who's on them and who they're open to have changed a lot. Who's in grad school in America has changed a lot. Is some of this going to be taken care of organically, or do you have to still be mindful about it, as mindful about it in 2018 as you were in the 1990s?
I regret to say we still have to be as mindful. We still, if we look at the numbers of in leadership, at best it's what I call creeping incrementalism. We make a little bit of progress, and then it slips back a little, and then we make a little bit more progress. We look at places like Wall Street. With the economic downturn, the people who left, by and large, were women who were placed in high middle management, who are poised to get to the next level. So what we have seen so far statistically is that we've made progress in the middle, but that progress of feeding the pipeline has yet to translate into real leadership.
Adrienne LaFrance, if you look at women getting PhDs, if you look at the number of women in law school, in med school, the numbers have changed radically, drastically. Does this promise a different lineup of experts in 2028?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, I think we also have to consider some of the external forces that that mean women, even when they're asked, are not always available to go on panels. I mean, for TV booking especially, it can be very last minute, it can be weekend, and women overwhelmingly are responsible for more of the primary child care in their families. So there are a lot of other systematic forces to contend with.
Charlestown, Massachusetts is next. Eden, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. I really appreciate you drawing attention to this issue. I don't think women are just underrepresented in journalism, which brings us the news, but in who is doing the research that supplies our information. For example, I'm currently completing my doctorate in psychology, and my thesis is focusing on the experience of first-time mothers in graduate programs and how we can better support mothers trying to finish their degrees.
And what have you? What are you on your way to concluding?
Well, I'm realizing that, you know, women have a lot more social expectations for caregiving, whether it's the idea of the second shift of taking care of children while working outside the home, or getting put on the mommy track, choosing or being forced into part-time positions that really prevent you from attaining leadership positions in any expert field. So basically, if women can't complete these expert degrees, then yes, there is only a male viewpoint. But it's more than that, too, because it's what we learn, what we know, what we even think is worth investigating, and therefore what we believe is truth. So I kind of want to know, what is higher education doing to adjust its structures and policies to better support women and mothers to reach these expert roles?
Certainly, if you hear the stories from the trenches, I guess the short answer, Eden, is not enough, right?
Exactly. I have two young girls myself, and it is a daily struggle, and I have plenty of power and privilege in my roles, but it's incredibly difficult. You really get pigeonholed.
Adrienne LaFrance?
I think it's an excellent point. And I wanted to go back, too, to something that Gail mentioned about how things haven't really changed. Looking at TV specifically in terms of representation, I mean, if you look at the sort of the gender breakdown among anchors, this is from the Global Media Monitoring Project, which is a group that looks really closely at some of these issues. And they found in their most recent report that that young women, there's just a sort of gross overrepresentation of young women as anchors. By the time you get to the 50 to 64-year-old age bracket, women disappear from television. And so I think you're looking at the people who are ostensibly the most experienced. They're at the toward the end of their careers, and they run out of opportunity.
Gail Evans, I'm right up against the break, but I definitely want to hear from you on that part of the conversation. We're checking ourselves. We as journalists, you as listeners, viewers, readers, and asking, are we open to the best expertise there is to be found in our universities, in government, and elsewhere? You tell us, do you go as far as to favor women scientists and other experts? Why is that? Do you get an incomplete picture of the world from the American news business because the voice of authority that's so often heard in writing, on screen, on the radio, is a male voice? I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.
There's nothing like a movie theater on a hot day, and there's nothing like a good show you can binge watch with a cold glass of lemonade. Summer is the perfect time to find your next favorite thing, and Pop Culture Happy Hour is here to help. Find us on the NPR One app or wherever you get podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. My guests and I are talking about what we think of when we think of experts, and whether our business, the news business, is turning to the best and brightest to explain the world. Listeners, grade us. How are we doing? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests are David Leonhardt of The New York Times, Adrian LaFrance, editor of TheAtlantic.com, and Gail Evans, former executive vice president of CNN. It doesn't seem, at quick glance, at a, let's say, non-analytical glance, Gail Evans, that women are doing too badly when you turn on TV news.
Well, I think one of the things, and the point about young women and old men is still so true. If you look at local news, you see many, many more women. They are all young. They are all attractive. They are all dressed intentionally as eye candy for the audience. So I think that we see a change. We see a change at the networks where they're women of substance, but we still are stuck in the place that women do not look like they are the commanding experts, that they are the people with the real power, and that they are the leaders. And it's interesting, the woman who talked about the PhDs, one of the things that we know about this society is that a PhD matters, but the network you have that exposes you to more people matters more than the PhD. And so just having the degree is not going to shift who gets the important job, who appears on the air, and the rest. So I want to be hopeful, but I teach undergraduate students and MBAs, and I still see a huge difference between where the men see themselves in 10 years and where the women see themselves.
Chicago's our next stop. Derek is on the line. Derek, welcome to On Point.
Hello. Hi, Ray, and hello. Say hello to your guests. Actually, I happen to be a U.S. correspondent for Radio Centrale in Belgium, and I do programs for them occasionally every couple of weeks on the U.S. politics. And one thing I would like to suggest, basically, to look at the makeup of the boards of each individual broadcaster or corporation that actually makes up, the advisory and regulatory corporate directives towards the management of each individual company. And you can also see the disparity between how many people or female gender are represented on the board versus the male. So I think this will give you a first indication exactly how the culture within the whole organization is really being shaped. But I also have a bit of a criticism about your program, to the degree where you really don't look at the quality of reporters that are being sent out, specifically when it comes to international affairs and the foreign policy issues. I'll give you an example. I covered recently Ukraine as well as I was in Sweden, covering a variety of different political, geopolitical issues. And when I often ran into my American colleagues, I seem to be being really parachuted by really any kind of deeper understanding of the historical and political context. I would say very few of them speak more languages than one or two, where in European media you have people who speak three, four. I'm myself am fluent in five languages, for example. So this really also comes across the degree of cultural ignorance as well as the incapability to really understand deeper issues that go beyond that. And if I often, the most important criticism I think I have towards the U.S. media is basically having this type of conversation right now at this time, it kind of represents the reshuffling of the chairs on the deck of the Titanic in a way, where we have so many different issues which are really percolating not only in geopolitical structure of our democracies, but also within our political structures. They increase inequality, also increase a variety of different issues that are bringing this our current situation to a global conflict, which your previous caller alluded to previously, I think, rather courageously. And I think this is something that really needs to be addressed much more in American public media versus this type of degree of identity politics, which I think really goes nowhere.
Well, I'll take your criticism that American correspondents covering the world are often not as well-schooled as they should be, and as you use the term, parachute, yes, they often parachute in to places to do stories. But the idea that until we take care of other big systemic problems, we can't talk about this one, I'm not so sure about that. But, Derek, thanks a lot for your call. Terry's next from Barrington, Rhode Island. Terry, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray.
Hi.
So I have something positive to say, and it's an old story. I have a PhD in economics. I was on the faculty at Penn State. I did research I stumbled into something, and that was, it was in 1990, and what I observed was that self-employment was rising. It was rising for men, but it was rising for women, and no one had really seen this before. And I had ideas about why this was happening, and I presented the research in December 1990 at the AEA meetings, the American Economic Association meetings. And at those meetings was Louis Uchtdel of the New York Times. And he came up to me, and he said, oh, Professor Devine, this is fascinating. I'd love to write a story on it. And he then later that week contacted me, and he did, write a story. But what was interesting was that, of course, he wanted additional sources, and he contacted people, and all of whom happened to be men. There weren't a lot of women economists in those days, actually, but all of them happened to be men. But the reason I say this is a positive story was that he sought me out, and then he viewed me as the most reliable source because, quite honestly, these guys were willing to say stuff that they couldn't say, like the data, the findings were not there to support what they wanted to say, the speculation, basically. And he would come to me and he would ask me. And then later, when he worked on self-employment stories after that, he came back to me. And I actually admired the man before I, interacted with him. But I just wanted to throw that out. Now, I'll point out, at this point, I'm 59, and my career probably was affected negatively because I was a woman over the years in many ways. But I just wanted to throw that out as one point where, that the press can do a good job.
Well, Terry, and it's important for us to hear from someone like you that once you broke through, you could be used on subsequent stories. It wasn't just because you, in your own words, stumbled onto something in 1990. You were used that once because you had gotten there first and then never again. There is a learning curve here, Adrienne LaFrance, and I guess Terry's evidence of that.
There is, and it takes time. I mean, after the second sort of self-analysis I did of my own work, as part of that piece, I put a sort of call out to people saying that I was looking for more roboticists and other people working in technology for the beats I was covering at the time, and specifically looking for the really smart women who could help improve my journalism. And I heard from, dozens and dozens of people, and it took a really long time to go through those emails and calls and reach out to people and figure out which people really were good sources. But it did make my work better. I learned things I maybe wouldn't have otherwise. And it was a really good example of why this isn't just something we need to correct because it's right or fair, but it leads to better journalism.
And I do want to – I didn't want to give Derek short shrift. I want to hear from David and Gail on his proposition that this is way down on the list of priorities in the challenges facing American journalism. Did he have a point, Gail Evans?
I think he does have a point. I mean, I think that one of the things that's happened to American journalism is we've become obsessed with one story. And what happens with the public is when you have one story, the public just feeds it because they love hearing more and more and more about that one story. And so what you don't begin to do is bring in real thoughtful experts about all of the other important issues which face this country. But I wanted to add one quick thing because I think this is also positive, that all of our experts used to say they had 4 calls by the time they got back to their office if they were on CNN and Company.
Ah, there we go.
And from other media, yeah.
Exactly. Right. That's how this reinforces itself.
Right.
Gail Evans is former executive vice president of CNN and creator of the show CNN and Company. Gail, great to have you with us. David Leonhardt is op-ed columnist at the New York Times. Good to talk to you again, David.
Thank you, Ray.
And Adrian LaFrance is the editor of TheAtlantic.com. Great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
In a moment, the summit between President Trump and North Korea's Kim Jong-un is called off. This is On Point. The news broke this morning that the big summit between the American president and the North Korean supreme leader, Kim Jong-un, scheduled for next month, has been called off. For more, let's turn to Nick Wadhams in Washington. He covers the State Department for Bloomberg News. Nick, thanks for joining us. When did the first word drop that the summit was unraveling?
I would say about a half an hour ago, maybe a little more. The White House circulated the president's letter in which he said that the summit, he was going to back out of the summit and it would not happen. So we just got about an hour ago.
There had been a rising tide of statements from the North Korean side that was beginning to, I think it's fair to say, cast doubt on whether this Singapore summit was going to happen. Were there from the American side, similar statements that began to make this look like it was less than a lead pipe cinch?
That's right. I mean, essentially what happened was that everything was sort of humming along smoothly and the U.S. was talking very confidently about this. I mean, there had even been some speculation that the president might win the Nobel Prize and the Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts. And then you had some statements out of North Korea last week threatening to pull out of the summit. And then there was a response from the U.S. The president himself said, maybe it'll happen. I would still like it to happen. So we've sort of been observing this spiraling down. Then it really sort of came to a head in the last day or two where Vice President Pence was talking about the so-called Libya model, where he said, you know, if North Korea does not denuclearize, they can expect the Libya model, i.e., when Colonel Gaddafi was overthrown by his own people. North Korea responded very angrily to Vice President Pence, and then you had President Trump today backing out of the summit.
There were points at which it almost seemed like both sides had lost their interest in really going ahead with this thing. When you're talking about the Libyan model, in the context of a leader of a country that is more than anything else interested in the continued survival of its own regime, isn't that provocative enough that you think, wow, maybe they're really trying to throw a monkey wrench into this?
There was certainly a lot of suspicion about that, particularly from a couple weeks ago when the National Security Advisor, John Bolton, brought up the Libya model in the first place. It was seen as such a sort of inflammatory and provocative statement that North Korea couldn't help but respond. John Bolton has always been skeptical about the idea of an agreement that would be reached between the two sides. I mean, for me, the big thing is when you look at this in the last week or two, it almost seems inevitable that this was going to happen because the risks were so great, particularly for President Trump, to show up, to shake hands with the leader of North Korea, and then to get nothing more than a commitment that North Korea could then backtrack on. The stakes were so high, and if he came out of that meeting without a total dismantlement of the North Korean nuclear program, which seemed extremely unlikely, it was essentially going to be viewed as a failure for the president.
Oh, let me follow up on that, because that very idea that North Korea was going to denuclearize, there seemed points in the public statements of the two sides like they were going to two different meetings.
That's right. I mean, and this has always been the question dating back decades. What does it mean when you say North Korea would denuclearize? They see it as much more of a broader sense in terms of a global campaign toward disarmament. Synchronous steps. Okay, we'll take one step. You give us sanctions relief. We'll take another step. You reduce your troop numbers in South Korea. Whereas the U.S. said, no, you have to give up all of your nuclear weapons first. Then we'll talk about the idea of you receiving some economic benefit later on. And that was always the big question with this summit. Okay, what are you going to get from the North Koreans? Now, Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, he met twice with Kim Jong-un. He said they did have a sort of meeting of the minds where he felt confident that North Korea was willing to do what the U.S. wanted. You started to see in the last couple of days the U.S. hedging. Yesterday, Mike Pompeo said he wanted to see credible steps from North Korea, not complete denuclearization. President Trump had also said that, so it seemed like the U.S. was moderating its position a little bit, but now here we are and the summit's off.
President Trump went as far as to say that at the conclusion of the talks, Kim Jong-un would be very happy and his country would be very rich. Members of Trump's own inner circle talk about things like regime change in North Korea. And there was the president talking about the Kim dynasty being more secure at the end of all this.
The administration had backed off that talk of regime change in recent weeks, and in fact had said that they were willing to provide security assurances to Kim Jong-un if he did go ahead with this deal. And that's believed to be one of the things that he's really seeking. Okay, if we give up these weapons, which we have basically pursued to protect ourselves, that you then would make sure you do not attack us. So the administration had come around quite a lot on that. And Pompeo yesterday, for example, when he was testifying before the House, said, yes, the U.S. was willing to provide those assurances for the North Korean regime.
Quickly, before we go, is there still enough buy-in in the Trump administration that we may see this idea resurrected down the road?
Yes, I think so. The Secretary of State said today he's still optimistic that a deal can be reached. It may just be that they want to do more planning, but they are still claiming they want to do a deal with the North Koreans.
Nick Wadhams, State Department reporter at Bloomberg News. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
You can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bowman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Imada, Stefano Kotsonis, Allison Poli, Catherine Proctor, Tanya Rally, Jeremy Relosa, and James Ross. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Coming up tomorrow, North Korea summit canceled, the GOP-only FBI briefing, gun safety summit in Texas. It's our weekly news roundtable. I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.